Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salam ala ashraf al-anbiya wal-mursaleen, Nabina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa ashabihi ajma'in, amma ba'd. So before I jump into the topic, I just wanted to say it brings me a lot of pleasure to be here, mashallah. You know, I visit communities in various states, and I'm always really happy when I come back to EPIC. So I haven't been here since before COVID. I think we did a dawah training or something a few years ago. But it's very nice to be back. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless you and bless your community, mashallah. And so with that said, let me jump into the topic. Now, the topic itself, where I want to start from, is the idea of truth itself. Now, I know we were going to talk a little bit about some deep philosophical concepts. I won't get too philosophical tonight, I hope, inshallah. Okay? The concept of truth itself. Now, one of the phenomena of the current day and age that we live in is that the very conceptualization of truth has come under attack. So now that sort of conceptualization of truth, either it's come under attack within academia itself, so you have concepts like postmodernism, which put truth on a certain scale and say it's fluid, right, and it's relative. But the concept of truth that I wanted to speak about tonight, in fact, is the one where a person would jump online and try to find information about a certain topic. And what happens is that when you jump online and you try to find information about a certain topic, what we have to realize is that the information that you are getting is not necessarily fact. Surprise, surprise, right? But this leads to a certain deep problem. And if what that problem is that it comes down to an issue of trust. They did some studies looking at how much people trust the government. And you look at these studies, they say in the 1960s, the trust of the government was running about 60%. Anyone want to guess what it is now? 30? Close. 20. It's about 20%, you know? Now, the thing is that you have a mistrust of the government. You have the mistrust of certain religious figures as well, for whatever reasons. And we're not only speaking about Islamic figures here. We're not only speaking about like mashayikh and stuff like that, but even within the Christian church, in synagogues, Judaism, and so on and so forth. There's a mistrust of religious figures. But the one that hits the hardest for the liberal worldview that we're in is the mistrust of science itself. So what you find is that, especially in a post-COVID world, maybe I shouldn't say post-COVID world, in a world that now we've hopefully transcended COVID, you find that the very concept of trusting the scientific community has also gone by the wayside. So as Nick Enfield here writes, he says, we're in a post-truth world and with eroding trust and accountability, it can't end well. Many academics, philosophers, thinkers, are looking at the state that we're in right now and seeing that it's not going in a good direction. Of course, you know, when you jump on hailed for you, anytime you do a search, it's as if whatever sort of cognitive bias you have, it just elevates that bias. So if you're doing a search, for instance, for climate change is, Google fills in the blank based upon an avatar that they've made of you based on information, your search history, and so on and so forth. So even if you wanted to transcend or go beyond, let's say you wanted new information, you wanted to have an open mind, quote unquote, this becomes extremely difficult in the environment that we're in. Okay, so news stories. Accurate stories rarely reach more than 1,000 people, yet most prominent false news items routinely reach between 1,000 and 100,000. This was a PBS report. False news stories. So the thing is, I have a certain thesis here before I, you know, go too deep into our cognitive biases and things like that. This is the central thesis for tonight. That in a world where truth itself has come under attack, one of the issues, like I said, within academia is that it's come under attack from an academic standpoint to say, You know what? Under postmodernism, the truth itself is relative, and they have their own theories as to why it has to do with linguistics. Again, it's outside the scope. What I wanted to present tonight is that our exposure to beauty, and the more exposure to beauty a person has, the greater your ability to see the truth really is, to see truth as it really is. Is there an absolute truth? It's not a rhetorical question. Very good. Okay. Al-haqqu min rabbik, right? The truth is from your Lord. So there's an absolute truth, obviously. And the main absolute truth is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, this is the central thesis. So, but why is this central thesis true? Why? How am I going to make this case? It's true because natural beauty facilitates something called awe, which leads to a heightened cognition and a decrease in ego. So what I'm saying now, and what we'll delve into, is that the reason why your exposure to beauty leads to the truth is for two reasons. Number one, it actually helps you with your cognition. It helps you think clearly. And number two, it is a means to decrease your ego. And one of the main impediments to the truth is what? Ego. What's the proof? From an Islamic worldview. Shaitan, thank you, right there. One of the main impediments. What else? What's another evidence? Trump. Okay, anyway, a little more classical evidence. Something from the Sira. Abu Jahl, right? So you find, time after time after time, one of the main impediments, one of the main things to block someone from the truth is their ego. How do you deal with that? Well, we're going to see tonight, bi'ithnillah, that one of those solutions has to do with exposure to beauty. Okay. All right, so central thesis, exposure to natural beauty can help us decrease cognitive biases. Number two, exposure to natural beauty can help us decrease our ego. All right. How many people have seen this experiment before? It's called the Franz Mirror Liar Rule Lines. Anyone seen it? A few people. Who's studying psychology here? All right, cultural psychology, nobody? Anyways, khair, no problem. Which line is longer? Which vertical line is longer, excuse me? Is it this one here? The one on the, I guess, the left? Or the one on the right? Okay, how many people say it's the same? Or you see it as the same? Not that they're the same, but you see it as being the same. How many, raise your hands. All right, how many people see it as being different? Raise your hands. Okay, we have a slight majority there. So this very experiment, it actually is rooted, it was actually done by Franz Mirror Liar back in the 1800s. And by and large, you would find the people that were put under the conditions to look at the line said that this line here, on average, was 20% longer than this line here. That's what they saw. Now the thing is, in reality, the line itself is of equal length. It's an optical illusion. But is this optical illusion, is this cognitive gap that we have, is this something that's true across the board, across the world? In fact, when the experiment was repeated in the 1960s, they looked at people who were weird. Weird being an acronym, actually, right? So it's not that they're weird, but it stood for Western, educated, industrialized, forgot what the exact thing was, let's see, do I have it up? There we go. Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic societies. So in those societies, in other words, in the Western world as we know it, every time people would be exposed to those lines, they would find that they would be subject to the optical illusion. But in the 1960s, they decided to increase the domain of the people that were exposed to this very experiment. So they traveled outside of the Western world. And when they exposed people from other communities and other countries, specifically rural communities, specifically communities within Africa, they found, by and large, that the people that were exposed to these two lines didn't see the optical illusion at all. Two specific communities. One was the Suku tribe in northern Angola and the Bidi tribe in the Ivory Coast. They didn't see the optical illusion at all. So now one reason that there'd be a difference is perhaps there's a difference in biology. Maybe their neurological structures are different. But they found that by and large, human beings have very similar neurological structures. They're not different. So what could be the other reason why these people did not see the optical illusion? Well, one of the reasons that they proposed was because of their environment. And this is why I asked if anyone studied cultural psychology. The culture and the environment actually had an impact on their ocular senses. All right, why do we see it? Why do we see the optical illusion? And we here, I'm talking about the Western world. It actually has to do with the architecture that we are grown up in. All of the architecture that you find, including this masjid, is very angular. It's straight. So our depth perception over time goes in that direction, in the sense that our ability to see things and our ability to understand depth perception is based on very angular structures. But those two tribes, one of the things we noticed is that their conditions that they're brought up in, their entire life, there are no angular structures. Their houses are by and large round or closer to nature, and you don't really find angular structures so much in the natural world. Right? You find trees and rivers and so on and so forth. And so what they found is that that exposure for their entire life to the architecture that you're surrounded by actually has an impact on your cognition. It leads to a cognitive bias, your surroundings, how you've been brought up. And so this is just on a side note, where we're going, right? So in the pre-modern world, you find that because people had a more of a God-centric, a theocentric worldview, their architecture reflected that as well. So many of the architecture that you find, whether we're talking about living conditions, whether we're talking about religious spaces, a lot of the architecture was a lot less cerebral and cold and clinical. It was a lot more connected with the natural world. But you enter into, let's say, the modern phase, and you have deeply angular structures that are related to utility, in the sense that when you go into an office, the idea is how do you maximize productivity of your worker, right? And hence all of the color, the shape of the building, and all of that is put together, is constructed in a way to maximize productivity, right? And of course, then you have the postmodern world, which we're not going to get into. It's outside the scope of this discussion, but that's the mess it looks like, right? Okay. So here's the thing. The question is, with cognitive biases, if we understand that as human beings, we have cognitive limitations, our minds are limited. So if that's the case, can we trust ourselves on every single occasion? No, right? You can't, not on every single occasion. Yes, we do certain acts to transcend those cognitive biases, no doubt. The reason why we know those lines are of different length or same length is because we actually took a ruler and measured it. But every single human being has cognitive limitations. And the thing is, in the modern world, we hate that. Like everyone understands we have ocular limitations, right? Like I can't see what's going on in the neighborhood next door, like across the street or wherever it is. And we're fine with that. We don't say like, okay, we're gonna stop seeing, forget it. We can't trust our eyes. Or auditory limitations. We don't say like, I can't hear what's going on three streets down, and therefore forget it. I don't need to worry about my ears. But for some reason, not for some reason, we'll get into the reason, that when it comes to cognitive limitations, the idea that my intellect has limits is very troublesome for the human being. Okay? But it's a reality. So what do we do as human beings? When we want to transcend our cognitive biases, there's a couple of things we do. We get the help of technology. So we're going to be talking a little bit later about maps. But I want you to think about, and there's actually some studies done on this as well, the main cartographer out of the Library of Congress, he did some studies on the history of map making. And what he said is, when you look at how maps progressed over human history, and we're talking about the Library of Congress, so they have a lot of data to go through. They said it's much like when a child is told to draw pictures. So when a child is told to draw your environment, they draw things that are not necessarily of proper height and length and so on and so forth. In fact, it's very egocentric. the child draws themselves very large and draws everything around themselves relatively smaller. Because they're having a direct experience of the space that they're in. So similarly, when you look at how maps were made in the pre-modern world, when maps started, they started by way of just travel. Your experience by how you travel the land is how you would map out things. And then as time goes on and technology gets better, you're able to measure things. But what's really fascinating is that when you think about maps, they actually have an impact on you as much as a cartographer would have an impact on the map. What do I mean? Your spatial perception, how you walk around and how you identify things, if you didn't have maps, you would have a certain way of going about doing that. But because of the maps and how they've been constructed, you understand reality not necessarily based on direct experience, but based on the cartography, based on the map. And so technology, what it does is, it helps us to transcend cognitive biases. Another example, time. When you think about how we measure time, or before you had clocks, before you had watches, if one needed to understand time and measuring time, how do you think they went about doing that? What was the means? How do you measure time? The sun, right? The days and the nights, the alteration. And there was a very deep connection with the natural world. And time was more or less linear. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that because you had a certain, let's say, agrarian rhythm, how the sun rises and falls, how the rain falls, how do you look at the stars, all of those are experiencing time in a linear fashion. It's just happening as you're going through. But what happens when clocks develop? You start breaking up time further and further and further. So you get to certain general concepts like years, months, weeks, days, hours, seconds. As you start breaking these things down and you're able to measure them based on this idea of heightened productivity, you find it moves from a linear understanding of time that you experience to a serial concept of time, where you have to get one thing done after another, the elevation of productivity. And in fact, these clocks, one of the first clocks, the reason why they were put into place, it was done by the church because they had to actually divide up prayers, and I think they had too many in the sense that they had like 7 or 10 or something like that, and they had to be done extremely precisely. So the whole concept of clocks and weights and things like that comes about from the church because of this concept of measurement. But what happens in the process? Your experience of space, your experience of time changes because of the technology. How you experience these things. And in fact, within our tradition, when it comes to the prayer time, how do we determine it? IslamicFinder.com, you get the app, right? That's how we do it. And that's how we do it now. But let's say you didn't have clocks. You didn't have apps. What are you supposed to do? The sun. You open any classical book of fiqh, they don't say, okay, visit www.ineedaclock.com, right? They said you got to actually look at the sun. So there's a very deep connection with the natural world, even when it comes to our the acts of worship that we have. But this concept of time being divided further and further to increase productivity, that it's interesting because even when you look at the Quran, for instance, there's a distinguishing word between serial time and linear time, right? So imagine this. If human beings didn't exist, like so let's say we all just disappeared all of a sudden, time, there's no concept of it being serial, of being broken down, because there's no clocks, because there's no one to use the clocks. So time just flows, it's linear. The concept of serial time only occurs when you have a human being to divide up time into further smaller and smaller increments. That's why when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions this type of time, serial time, he says, wal asr, innal insana lafi khusr. By time, serial time, you're in a loss, right? Because it's breaking down, it's going away, you're losing time. But when it comes to the non-existence of human beings, let's say when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us, هَلْ أَتَىٰ عَلَى الْإِنسَانِ هِنَ مِنَ الدَّهْرِ لَمْ يَكُنْ شَيْئًا مَذْكُورًا. Has there not come upon the human being a time, dahr, when he wasn't a thing mentioned? Why did he use dahr? Because this is now linear time. It doesn't have to do with measurement. Because the human being is a thing that's not even mentioned. It's before the human being was even there. So anyway, I actually went on a very long tangent. I wasn't supposed to do that. All right. So can you trust, if you can't trust yourself, one way is technology, but the other way is relying on the say-so of others. Testimonial knowledge. How many people, actually before I get to this quote, how many people think that you don't need to rely on the say-so of anybody else? You can do it all yourself. I think everyone agrees, right? You cannot, in fact, what I'll say is that testimony, relying on the say-so of others, is a fundamental part of what we call epistemology. Epistemology is the study of how we know what we know, the study of knowledge. A fundamental part of that is testimony, testimonial knowledge, what you get from the say-so of others. All right? And then so we do these fun experiments with people. We always tell people, like, if you don't believe it, like, just ask yourself, well, first of all, how many people here believe that the world is round and not flat? Okay, how many people don't believe that? Because that would be fun. Oval, round, you know, you get it. Okay, how do you know that? How do you know it's round? How do you know it's round? You saw it on a show. Okay, how do you know it's round? If you go into space. Okay, good. Can anyone prove to me that the world is round or oval, not flat, without reference to testimony? You cannot use the say-so of others. Sorry? What about the sun? Okay, so? Okay, maybe. But how do you know that? Someone else told you, right? All right, yeah. Sorry? Gravity. Okay, I don't know what that means, man. It's just, I could throw a word out there. It's like, gravity. Water would fall down. You, like from where? From the sky. Water does fall down. We have rain. Okay, how do you know that? How do you know the water would fall based on gravity off the sides of the earth? How do you know that? Someone told you. You read it in a book. You saw a YouTube video, right? You didn't go off the side of the cliff. You didn't go around the entire earth, right? Okay, fair enough. What I'm trying to say is that that concept of testimony is fundamental to knowing what you know. If I asked you, how do you know your mother is your mother? Without reference to testimony, could you prove it to me? How many people think you could prove that your mother is your mother without reference to testimony? I always get that. I always get the DNA test. How many people think a DNA test would solve the issue? Raise your hands. A DNA test. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, a whole bunch of people. A DNA test. Okay, how do you know the DNA test works? Like when you send your blood off to cyberspace, right? How do you know the results you're getting are actually the correct results? How do you know that? Trust. Testimony. Science or signs? Science. Okay, how do you know that though? You still need testimony. Like if we took the entire world of science, right? Whatever field you want, medicine, engineering, whatever field, can you make scientific progress without testimony? No way. You cannot do all the experiments yourself. You cannot do an empirical analysis on literally everything. You have to rely on the testimony of those that came before you, okay? Yes. I would say almost everything, because there are certain things you directly experience, which we'll get into in a second. That's actually the topic. Okay, so that's why when we ask, can we trust others? I believe this is Elizabeth Fricker. She's a professor at the University of Oxford. She said it should be immediately obvious Oops. It should be immediately obvious that in the conditions of modern life, we rely hugely on the epistemic and practical skills of others. For example, I allow my car mechanic to fix, or sorry, my car mechanic to find out what is the fault, what the fault is with my car when it won't start, and then to fix it for me. And one relies on one's doctor to use information from symptoms and medical tests to diagnose what is wrong with one and then prescribe an appropriate treatment. You rely upon the knowledge and cognition of others. That's my main point. The problem is if we have cognitive biases, don't the people we rely on also have cognitive biases? Yes, because they're human beings, right? We have biases. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor. You still have cognitive biases. So humans have cognitive biases. Individuals, we have our biases. If you rely on the say-so of others, they have their own biases. So how do we now get to absolute truth? How do we get to certainty, in fact, is what the question is. All right. Relying on the say-so of others. I want to make one more point here. And tonight's motif is maps, in case you haven't noticed. All right. So you see the map. This is the one that, you know, you may see in school, or maybe you have a globe or whatever, you've bought one. All right. When we look at maps in general, what you'll notice is that the North America, northern continent, is on top. But over here in Europe, Europe is on top, i.e. north. Africa and South Africa is at the bottom. Australia is at the bottom. And then all of, like, Russia is on top. Why is that the case? The reason why that's the case, because back when Ptolemy was constructing the map, his idea of what to put on top was dictated by what he felt was the superior culture, right? And so when you're going to draw a map, you're going to say what goes on top and what goes on bottom. What goes on top is that which is superior. And what goes on bottom is that which is inferior. So when constructing a map, Ptolemy didn't go to outer space and look at the world. He basically based his map on that particular idea of which one is superior. Ptolemy wasn't alone in that. Because even in the Muslim world, you have Muhammad al-Idrisi. He's a 12th century cartographer, map maker, draws the map as we know it upside down. I mean, according to our paradigm, it's upside down. Why? Because for him, the Islamic milieu, Islamic world, is supreme. So he draws Africa on top. He draws Mecca in the center. He draws Europe, plop, on the bottom, right? And something someone told me that was very interesting is that Muhammad al-Idrisi, in fact, resided in Spain during this time. So he actually, according to his map, was on the bottom. And Ptolemy at the time, when he drew his map, was actually in Egypt. So he was part of his own south, in his own, when he drew his map. Just a side tidbit, okay? Now here's the thing. Which map is correct? Both? Neither? Is there a correct map? No. So who cares? Like, why should we care what's north, what's south? Like, why does cardinal direction matter? In fact, in many studies, it does matter. They did a couple of studies. One study looked at the cost of moving and transport. And they said that when you look at distances, on average, in the United States, moving companies would charge for the same distance $265 more to go from south to north rather than going from north to south. Why? Because of that sort of perception that when you go up, it's harder. Like going up a hill, it's intuitively like, oh, it's really hard. Because it's on a map and it's north, it's up, so it must be harder. Based on that intuitive sort of feeling that we have, on average, they would charge $265 more going from south to north as opposed to going north to south. Cardinal direction. So all of these things, they have deep impacts on our day-to-day activities. How we think about things, our very cognition, okay? All right, if you went to outer space, you really couldn't tell which one was north, south, up, down. because there is no anchor. So there is no kind of quote-unquote right answer. So people and the ones we depend upon have their own cognitive biases. Even the maps. Google Maps is based on Ptolemy's map. And how many people rely on Google Maps daily? Most of us, right? The technological tools that we rely upon. Okay, let's come back to the central thesis because I don't want to get lost in the weeds. The greater your exposure to beauty, the greater your ability to see truth as it really is. So we've understood cognitive biases. We've understood that even if we rely upon the say-so of others, they have cognitive biases. We've seen that technology isn't a direct answer either, because it has its own issues, right? Remember that whole discussion on serial time versus linear time and so on and so forth. Okay, so let's talk about beauty now. I have a question up there. Is beauty part of our meta language? Okay, what's meta language? I don't know. I don't know either. No, I'm kidding. Who wants to guess what meta language is? Actually, I should probably move the slide because everyone's like reading it. Okay, what do you think meta language is? Okay, metaphysics. Close. Meta anything. What is it referring to? Like, think of anything else that has the word meta in it. So metaphysics, metaethics, yeah. Outside of this world. Okay, so metaphysics. Anytime you talk about a term that has meta in it, understand it generally refers to the foundation or the basis of something or that which is beyond something. So metaphysics is that which is beyond the physical world. That's why metaphysics is concepts like God, the Ruh, the soul. That's a metaphysical concept. Consciousness, metaphysical concept. All right? Metaethics. When we talk about metaethics, ethics are what is right and wrong. Metaethics is why is something right or wrong? Right? So if you think, okay, slavery is wrong. Okay, yes, but why? So the question of why, what's the foundation, what's the moral anchor, that's a metaethical question. Every single idea and thought has meta foundations of some sort. Language is no different. So when we talk about language, we have what we use in conversation, and then you have a meta language. And I'll explain that a little further now, okay? So when we look at ethical terms specifically, you have two types of terms, right? According to Tozuko Izutsu, he says you have primary terms and secondary terms. A primary term is descriptive in nature. It describes something. A secondary term is that which is evaluative. It gives a value. So let's give an example to clarify this. When you say someone is humble, they have humility. Humility is describing the person. So that is a primary term. It's describing something. But then you're going to ask, then you say the statement, humility is good. Good is your secondary term. You're using that to evaluate humility. So mercy is good. Humility is good. But you don't say, is good good? You need a foundation to start with. That foundation is what we call meta language. Okay? Now, typically, traditionally, there were three kind of areas of meta language. One was the idea of truth. The second was the idea of goodness. It could be moral, it could be ethical. But the third was, in fact, beauty. So St. Thomas Aquinas, however you say that, he actually talks about the good, the true, and the beautiful. And these are this is part of our meta language. When you say something, when you ask the question, why do you believe X? Because it's true. Why do you want Y? Because it's good. Why do you look at Z? Because it's beautiful. Is that a valid meta? Is that a valid part of our meta language? Because someone could say, isn't beauty in the eyes of the beholder? How many people have heard that before? Right? So beauty is subjective. So how could it be part of our meta language? In other words, it's the basis upon which we build language. How could that be? Secondly, when it comes to good and true, they actually can connect. Because you could say that the truth is good, and good is generally connected to the truth. But is beauty, our usage of the term, connected to truth and goodness always? Can you have a beautiful disease? We actually can. We use it in our language all the time. So because it doesn't have that connection, is it really part of our meta language? And I'm going to get into this a bit later. I'm going to argue that, in fact, it is part of our meta language. And our focus usually is on true and good, and we skip out through beautiful or beauty. Okay. Who's really confused so far? All of you? Okay, so now I'm going to make it even more confusing, and then I'm going to reel everyone back, bi'idhnillah, okay? So there's one more part that's very confusing, and then everyone's going to come back, bi'idhnillah, okay? Inshallah. Here's the part that's confusing. Because we want to look at, we were talking about beauty versus intellect, I want to spend just a minute here on understanding cognitive limitations or epistemic limitations, okay? Typically, when people talk about rationality, our aql, they basically give two types of, or they divide it into two. They claim something may be rational or irrational. So a rational statement, jazakallah khair, a rational statement is something like, I am Fahad. Very straightforward, rational statement. An irrational statement is if I said, I am a married bachelor. How many people think that is a totally rational statement? How many people think that's totally irrational? So no one's gonna come, like usually when I do this with Muslim communities, you always have that one guy. You know what one guy I'm talking about? The one guy, but in Islam, you got a furwa, it still doesn't work, man. Still doesn't work, okay? Because by definition, someone who's a bachelor is not married, and by definition, someone who's married is not a bachelor. What if I was obstinate? What if I was stubborn? And I said, you know what? I am a married bachelor. Prove to me that I can't be a married bachelor. How do you do that? Convince me. How are you gonna do it? I'm stubborn. I said, you know what? I am a married bachelor. Convince me otherwise. Sorry? My wife's not here. So this discussion can go wherever you want. She's not here. This isn't being posted live, is it? Okay, good. What's that? Yes, no, that's the right answer. What did he say? He said, we say salamu alaikum and move on. You want to know why? Because the thing is, what in essence am I saying? What am I demanding proof for? I'm demanding proof for you to prove a rational or logical principle. What is that principle? The principle of mutual exclusivity. You cannot have two things occurring at the same time. I cannot be Fahad and not Fahad at the same time, right? That's a logical principle. The problem is you can't prove the principle. You start with the principle, right? So like he said, if someone says, prove it to me, you'd be like, okay, we don't agree on the principle, masalama. That's it, I'm out of here, right? So in fact, there's not two categories of rationality. There are in fact three categories of rationality. You have that which is rational, right? Simple rational statement. Then you have that which is irrational, like this, you know, me being a married bachelor. And then you have something that is outside of rationality. It's not irrational, but it is outside of the very concept of rationality, like logical principles. And if you don't have them, rationality falls down. It's completely destroyed. Everyone understand these three categories? What if someone is stubborn and they say, you know what? I don't believe in the super rational. Like that's just you people who believe in God or whatever, you religious people, it's just a way for you to get away from proving things. I'm not gonna believe something unless you prove it to me. Okay, so this person is saying, I basically doubt everything. I'm not gonna believe it until I have proof. What is he saying? I doubt it. Can you doubt something forever? You can't. Like I give the example sometimes, I say, imagine my son, he comes into the kitchen and he takes out the knife and I tell him, I say, Abdurrahman, put the knife back. He says, why? Right? How many people have kids? You've heard this infinite loop question, right? Why? Because it's sharp. Why? Because the manufacturer made it that way. Why? Because we use it to cut things. Why? Because we cut things like apples. Why? Because apples have a greater utility when you eat them cut. Why? At a certain point, what is the answer? Because I said so and I'm your dad! Halas, right? You cannot ask why infinitely. There is no theorem that is infinitely defendable. You can't say because this, because this, because this forever. There has to be a stopping point. There has to be a meta. You can't ask why forever. So there has to be something that's outside of, and you can't say I'm gonna doubt everything. You can't just say I'm gonna be an absolute skeptic. You wanna know why? Because if you doubt everything, you have to doubt your doubt, which leaves you nowhere, right? So what we say is that the rationality, our aql, is an amazing tool. And you could compare it, someone that says, I'm only gonna use my aql, only gonna use my rationality, to someone who says, I have the perfect solvent. It can dissolve anything. So rationality is like a solvent. But if this person says, I have the perfect solvent, it can dissolve anything, you still need to ask him, what bottle are you gonna keep it in? Rationality is a great solvent. You still need a bottle to keep it in. You still need something that's absolute, that which is not soluble, that which is not solvable. You need something outside of rationality. And that's where you have things like logical principles, okay? Now, let's give it some Islamic parlance so that we can clarify things. All right, rationality, aql, something that's irrational, غير aqli, the super rational, that which is outside of rationality, is what we know as the fitra. And there's other things that are part of the fitra, right? Our perception and conceptualization of beauty is part of our fitra. Okay, let me stop here for one more second. When Allah speaks in the Quran, Allah Azza wa Jal uses ayat, right? All of us that have had any exposure to the Quran know this right away, okay? Is the Quran, is an ayah equivalent to a rational argument? Or let me rephrase that. Is it equivalent to a distinct syllogism? A, B, therefore C? Or is it different? Like when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أَفِلَّهِ شَكْ فَاتَرِ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. Is there any doubt concerning Allah? That's an ayah, right? Is that a rational argument? No, it's an ayah. So let's stop here for a second. What is an ayah? When you quickly translate an ayah, what do you translate it to? A sign, right? And then we move on. It's a sign. But I want us to stop here for a second and think about what a sign really is, okay? I want you to imagine, let's say, don't imagine, I actually experienced this. So I graduated, actually the gentleman who was driving me around asked me, like, you know, what did you major in college? And I was like, oh yeah, back in the Stone Age. I majored in econ, right? But imagine now that after all those years, right, I went to Michigan State University, graduated, now I live in Houston. So I'm going through my stuff. So this is like, whatever, 20 years ago, whatever it might be. All right, I don't want to date myself too much. 20 years ago, and I'm going through my stuff, and I find a box, and in the box, I pull out my graduation cap and my graduation robe. Immediately, I remember the day that I graduated. I remember going up on stage and having a last name that starts with a T and being extremely annoyed because there were 250 people there and I had to wait till almost the last guy. I remember that immediately. I remember the look on my parents' face, were like, wow, he actually graduated. I remember that too, right? All that stuff immediately comes back. Because, okay, so the question is, did I learn something new? Did I go through some sort of educational exercise to experience that? No. How much time passed between me seeing the cap and the garment and me having that experience? It was instantaneous. When you look at ayat, understand there's two qualities of an ayah. Number one, there's no information transfer. You don't learn an entire corpus of material, right, as you're experiencing the ayah. Yes, you can learn before that, and that gives you the experience, number one. Number two, the effect of an ayah is immediate. You experience it directly. So far, so good? Now, in this construct, the super rational, rational, and, well, irrational, not part of the discussion here, which one is higher? Which one is more important in this construct? The super rational, the fitra. Do you think that Allah targets primarily rationality or that which rationality it depends upon? The super rational, he targets the fitra. Everyone with me so far? So ayat have a function that in fact transcends mere syllogisms, mere discursive reasoning, right? Not that there aren't rational arguments in the Quran, there are. But understand when Allah says that he's speaking in ayat, right? Ayat, that there's a certain significance of that. In fact, our very language is all ayat. When you have words, they're pointing to, you're trying to express something and it has a meaning that points to something else. It's an ayah of what's inside, right? You're trying to express a feeling, I'm sad. The word sad is not the feeling. It is a sign of what you're trying to say, that I'm sad. So our entire concept when it comes to the Quran in terms of ayat primarily targets the fitrah. Okay, so is beauty part of the fitrah? It is, but now let's get into some details related to that. All right, let's conceptualize beauty. Now there are certain platitudes. There's a famous author, he actually passed away recently, Roger Scruton, and he says he has six platitudes. And I want us to think about this from that entire context of discussion that we had, right? When we talked about cognition, talked about rationality, now let's talk deeply about beauty and trying to really understand it. Six platitudes. He says, number one, beauty pleases us. Seems very simple. When you look at something beautiful, there's an experience of pleasure. Okay? Number two, one thing can always be more beautiful than another. You can have comparative beauty. Number three, beauty is always a reason for attending to the thing that possesses it. The reason why you're looking at something in terms of beauty is because of the beauty that's intrinsic to it. All right? Number four, beauty is the subject matter of judgment, the judgment of taste. This is where it gets a bit tricky, because you say beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. Remember that whole thing? But what I'm going to say is, in fact, beauty can be objective, meaning it's not subject to the person seeing it. In fact, there's a beauty that no matter who it is, and it's not contingent upon human emotions, that something is beautiful, right? We'll get there. So the judgment of taste is about the beautiful object, not about the subject's state of mind. This kind of goes to the point that I just made. It's not about the person looking at the thing, it's about the thing. Like when you say something is beautiful, you're not talking about me, like my eyes are, you're saying that thing that I'm looking at, it in and of itself, intrinsically, it possesses beauty. Okay? That's why you're looking at it in the first place. And then six, nevertheless, there are no secondhand judgments about beauty, and I'll come back to this. Okay, so let's now take a look at something. Beauty, if we're going to look at it, it is always going to be connected to something that has meaning. Okay? So, when we look at aesthetic beauty versus utilitarian interests, what do I mean? Aesthetics, something being beautiful, is different than the functionality of something. So why do I have a table set up there? When you invite a guest over for a meal and you set the table, is it purely just based on function? Usually it's not, if you're a good host, right? Or otherwise you just take out the paper plates and you throw them on there and be like, all right, khalas, it's easier to keep up. It's easier to clean up and you're done, right? That's a very mechanical, utilitarian way of giving someone food, yeah? Why do you set the table? And what does it say? When you see a table that's being set, it tells you something about your host. They want you to have a type of pleasure. Not the pleasure of the food that's about to be served, but the fact that they took their time out to decorate the table, to put all the plates out, to make it visually appealing, it has a meaning behind it. comparing that to something that's just utilitarian, that's a function, it's not related to meaning. So anytime you see something that is has a beautiful component to it, it necessarily is going to point to meaning of some sort. It has to be connected to meaning. Okay? Otherwise, it's just something you're doing based on functionality. Everyone understand this point? Yes? I hope that the table setting example helped. Okay. Art versus entertainment. All right, who's a Marvel fan here? Okay, who's a DC fan here? All right, make toba, khalas, go. No, I'm kidding. All right, why I have this up there is because I have a certain debate with someone that's very close to me. Between, like, I'm a Marvel fan, if you haven't noticed, right? And that gentleman is a DC fan. So every time we're talking about Marvel versus DC, he always tells me, he's like, Marvel is very superficial. Like, I mean, the heroes have no depth. Their backstory is weak, but when you go to DC, you've got these heroes that have this deep story, and you know, you look at like Zack Snyder and all of his, you know, the meaning behind it, and it's so deep and blah, 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 blah. So in this discussion, what usually comes up is me telling this person that, look, if I want meaning and I want to study something, I'll study a book. The whole reason I'm watching a movie is for me to turn off my brain and just experience entertainment. I'm just trying to be entertained. I don't care about the deeper meaning, right? But then this person will say, no, no, but you have to appreciate the art and the visual and the camera angle and who knows what else, right? But this brings up a point of the difference between art and entertainment. Art points towards something of meaning. It tells you something. So if you're watching, let's say, a movie and looking at look at the camera angle, look at the symbolism, you know, Superman being in a church, you know, what's the symbolism, what is it tying to, what is it telling us? All of those deeper questions about the artistic element of, let's say, a movie has to be connected to meaning. But if it's just entertainment, there's no concept of meaning. You are just going for a certain experience that's not tied to meaning. Okay? So far we've spoken about aesthetic versus utilitarian interest, art versus entertainment. There's one more, and this is the one I think you'll appreciate. Prose versus poetry. So what do I mean by prose? What do I mean by poetry? When you read a poem, what we understand is that a poem has a very different dynamic than simple prose. Okay? Typically, when you read a poem, you can read it again. You can revisit it. Typically, it will elicit an emotional response. Typically, it'll give you an indication of something that's deeper, that has meaning. Prose doesn't do that. So that's why I have up there an organic chemistry textbook. You never return back to it. Okay? Once you study organic chemistry, and let's say, that's it, halas, you're never going to revisit that book again. Right? Back in the days when they actually used to give you books, you would sell it. Okay? Never to see it again. Right? That's simple prose. Poetry is different. Like, for instance, I have up there Emily Dickinson's poem. It's called Hope. I want you to just listen to it for a second. All right? Understand how it's different than simple prose, simple information. And it's about hope. So, Emily Dickinson writes, "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. The sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I heard it in the chilliest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me." It's actually very beautiful, right? It's deep. Like, you want to think about it for a second. Like, hold on. She's talking about a concept of hope, comparing it to a bird. It's. I mean, there are levels that you can explore that you could read again and again and again, right? Poetry is different than prose. Poetry, you can ascribe beauty to it. Ascribing beauty to an organic chemistry textbook, you've got problems. Okay? All right. So this is why, when we're conceptualizing it, Kenneth Brooks, he writes in The Heresy of Paraphrase. He has a couple of things which he says that this is a heresy when it comes to trying to paraphrase a poem, right? To explain a poem, you know? And so he says, number one, poetry can express several thoughts at the same time. Prose doesn't do that. Number two, it's polysemous. In other words, meaning conveyed on several levels. That poem on hope, it's not just hope, but it's hope based on your experience. What those troubled times that you went through, it includes that. It has multiple layers and levels. Its meaning is lost in any paraphrase. Who's heard the term Bond, James Bond? Anyone heard this? They say is the most, the greatest one-liner to be said in all of cinematic history, okay? What is the great information that he's conveyed to you right now? Nothing great, okay? Could he have walked in and said, hello, I'm Mr. James Bond? He could have, or first name James, last name Bond. He could have. Why is it that when he comes in and says, Bond, James Bond, it's got a something, right? It's a rhetorical device. And that rhetorical device has actually been codified, right? That structure, A, B, A, you find in many things. Burn, baby, burn. Home, sweet home. It's a rhetorical device. And if you take that part of the rhetoric out, it renders it without the beauty as just a dude with a name, right? And that's what happens when we speak about this idea of meaning is lost in any paraphrase. When you try to explain it, it loses something. The last one is that sound is important. When you recite a poem, you'll find that how you recite it and how the sound as it comes out, it's actually important, especially when you have poems that rhyme. Yeah? Okay. So, this is, and I want you to think about this because I'm running short of time now. I want you to think about this when it comes to the Quran. The Quran is not prose and it's not poetry. But when you think about these points, sound is important. Even sound being connected to the meaning of the words in the Quran is important. Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim. The meanings of these two terms, I'm not going to get into this whole thing because I'm out of time. But sound is important. Paraphrase, and you can even include in that translation. Why is it not possible to translate the Quran? One of the reasons is because meaning is lost in, if meaning is lost in paraphrase, how much more so meaning is lost in translation? All right? Okay, now I need to drive this home, so I need to run this really fast. When we talked about is beauty, does it lie in the eyes of the beholder? This is the last thing I'll speak about. Why I say you can have beauty that can be objectively true, like something can be objectively beautiful and not subjectively beautiful, meaning it doesn't just, here I'm specifically speaking about natural beauty, not man-made beauty. Man-made beauty can be subjective. Natural beauty is never subjective. And you know one of the proofs of that? Whenever any marketer is trying to sell you something, they always call it what? Natural, all natural, organic, all these terms. Because our fitra understands that the natural world is unbiased, right? It doesn't have, so when we talk about beauty, subjective human work, it's biased. It has some sort of meaning, but beauty, when we look at natural beauty, it's objective, it's unbiased, and it also has a meaning. So now, this is a painting of the Niagara Falls, but it would be very different than actually experiencing the Niagara Falls. How many people have been to the Niagara Falls? Some people? Okay. Canadian side, right? Okay, good, because the American side, I don't know. Anyway, okay. Why is this the case? When you look at a painting or a picture of nature, there's framing. You are limited. You have a frame by which you're seeing it. Because you have a frame, there's a human angle and a bias. We're trying to do away with human biases, right? A picture gives you that human's angle. The direct experience is completely different. It's vast, open, and endless. There's no framing because you're directly experiencing all of that nature. Number two, there's no humor, angle, or bias. It's not contained, and this is the main one. It makes you feel small. Okay, so the thing is, I need like four more slides, but it's time for Isha. So I need to stop here. We still have 10 minutes? Okay. 5 minutes? Okay. Let me race through the rest of this as quickly as I can. All right. So that last point, it makes you feel small. When you see an enormous mountain, when you see the Niagara Falls, when you see something that just, it's grand, there's a certain feeling you go through. In English, it's called awe. But it's a type of fear, is it not? But it's not the fear where like, you know, like Mike Myers is chasing you type fear, right? Like you're about to be murdered. Not that fear. It's a different type of fear. A fear of like, okay, not that you're scared, but you feel small. In English, we call it awe. But everyone has experienced it, okay? All right, awe. And this is from a study done by Dacher Keltner and Michelle Sciotta. And they said, awe has been defined as an emotional response to perceptually vast stimuli that overwhelm current mental structures yet facilitate attempts at accommodation. All right. So, back to what I was saying in the beginning. All right, so if you remember our central thesis, beauty can lead us to truth. How is that so? Because A, it helps us with our cognition, it increases our, heightens our cognition, and B, it decreases our ego. And these are two facilitators towards the truth. Okay, so awe leads to decreased ego and heightened cognition. When you experience awe, two things happen. You become smarter, in a sense, your cognition actually gets heightened, and number two, you become more humble. Your ego goes down. Okay? How do we know this? Well, first of all, from the tradition. So the Prophet ﷺ says, no one will enter paradise who has an atom's weight of arrogance in his heart. A man said, what if a man likes his clothes to look good and his shoes to look good? So the Prophet ﷺ said, Allah is beautiful and he loves beauty. Inna Allah jameel wa yuhibbul jamal. Right? And then he defines arrogance. Al-kibru batrul haq wa ghamtun nas. That arrogance means denying the truth and looking down upon people. I want you to think about that for a second. Right? He's tied beauty, first of all, the attribute of Allah, Jameel, but he, what has he tied it with? Rejection of truth? Ego. Yeah, right? Okay, let's look at some studies real quick. The effect of awe on cognition. Now, what they did is, in this study, very quickly, they took some people and they put them in a natural environment, right? Like a mountain somewhere, something like that, okay? And they had them listen to a story for 5 minutes. And the story is some romantic story. Like, so they went out, they had dinner, you know, some sort of dinner, and they went home, and then that's it, whatever. It's a five-minute story. And then they asked the question, in the story that you heard, was there a candle on the table? Now, the thing is, as human beings, we have cognitive gaps that we fill in based on experience. When you think about a romantic dinner, you sometimes fill in the cognitive gaps, right? Unless you are paying attention. In this case, they had people that were in more of a city center versus a natural environment. So the correct answer was there was no candle on the table in the story. The people that had been taken up to the mountainscape or whatever were, I think it was 78%, answered the question correctly, 78% greater than the people that were just in a city center. Okay? So it has an effect on cognition. Number two, all right, so it, basically it awakens the mind. That's from, what about the effect of awe on the ego? So what they did is, they did some experiments on drawing yourself. They had you draw yourself in a city center, somewhere in San Francisco, and then they had another group of subjects draw themselves on a mountainscape. What they found is when the people drew themselves in a city center, they always drew themselves really big, right? When they drew themselves in a mountainscape, they always drew themselves small, extremely small. Now, what they found is that the results was that it, when you are exposed to natural beauty, it takes you from self-interest to collective interest. You move from thinking only about yourself to thinking about others. Number two, from isolated self to integrated self. You considered yourself part, not as an atomized individual, but as part of a community. All right? And finally, it breaks down us versus them thinking. All right. So awe, at the end of the day, diminishes ego. And I don't have time to get into the rest of the studies, but at the end of the day, my central thesis was the greater your exposure to natural beauty, the greater your ability to see truth as it really is. What beauty does, and the thing that's missing in the modern world, and I'll conclude here, is that very few people are exposed to natural beauty. Most of us spend our time indoors. Ask yourself, when was the last time you went outside and just looked at the sky and marveled? Many things within our tradition are there to tie us back to the natural world. Salatul Khusuf, the eclipse prayer. There's the prayer, but then there's the actual phenomenological aspect of looking at the eclipse and remembering Allah. Okay? So since I'm out of time, I'm going to go ahead and stop there. And I'll stick around at the end, after Salah, if anyone has questions or if they want me to kind of finish off the presentation. We'll see. Jazakumullah khair. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Ashhadu anna Muhammadan rasulullah.